Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Coming up today, record producers. They don't often become household names, but chances are you can name a few. George Martin, Phil Spector, Timbaland. But you might not know the late Tom Wilson, even though he shaped some of the best work from Bob Dylan and Simon and Garfunkel. We'll hear why Texas Monthly recently dubbed Tom Wilson the greatest producer you've never heard of. Also on the show today, a couple of debuts. Most of us first met Nina Persson as a member of this Swedish pop band, The Cardigans. This song, Love Fool, was a big hit for the Cardigans in the late 90s, and singer Nina Persson went on to form a bunch of collaborative projects. But now she's finally releasing her first official solo record. It's called Animal Heart, and she'll play a couple of songs from it in our studio. So that's one of our debuts. The other is actually an anniversary.
As merry as the days were long, I was right when you were gone.
30 years ago today, the English rock band The Smiths released their self-titled debut album. In a moment, we'll talk with Smiths biographer Tony Fletcher about the record, but first I'm joined by Soundcheck executive producer Joel Meyer. Why, Joel? Why are you here?
John, we are going to talk about The Smiths in just a moment, both the album and the band. But for just one moment, John, I want to talk about one specific Smith, that being Morrissey, the singer. And I want to announce the kickoff of Soundcheck's latest project, the Morrissey Book Club.
Is this like the Oprah Book Club?
No. Unlike the title might suggest, these are not books selected by Morrissey. This is an excuse for me to read the Morrissey autobiography, which was just published late last year, and encourage those of you out in the audience who have also been wanting to read it but have been maybe a little scared to read it by yourself to come form a team and form the Morrissey Book Club.
All right. Now, how does one join this team?
John, there's no membership fee. There's no obligation to buy. All that you need is a copy of the book, either a physical copy or a Kindle copy. You can have the American version or the UK version. Well, there's some differences between the two, and we'll be talking about that online. But the idea is we just want you to read the book with us over the course of 3 weeks, about 150 pages each chunk, and we're going to talk about it online, maybe with some special guests as well, too. That's the Morrissey Book Club.
All right. So folks go to soundcheck.org to get all the details.
And that's right. That's right. Today is really the official kickoff day. So next Thursday is your next due date. You have to reach page, I believe it's 150 about by next Thursday.
All right. Do you have to be an obsessive Morrissey or Smiths fan to join this club?
You don't. And I'm going to confess here, I'm not an obsessive Smiths or Morrissey fan. I love both of those, you know, artists, mm-hmm. but I'm not the kind of person that has, like, say, a Morrissey face tattoo on my chest, which is like a real thing. Now, we need a few of you to join the Morrissey Book Club. Don't get
the
me
obsessives.
Wrong. Yeah, the obsessive. We need some of you in there, but if you're just a casual fan, you're welcome too.
Tony Fletcher is joining us to talk about the anniversary of the debut album by The Smiths, but as long as he's here, Tony, what has Joel gotten himself into?
Oh, he's gotten himself into a whole lot of trouble here. But Morrissey's autobiography is about as opinionated an autobiography as I have ever read in my life. And separating Morrissey's opinion from fact is going to be enormously interesting over your coming weeks. The first section, I have to say, is enormously readable. It's pre-Smiths, pre-music. It's about growing up in Manchester. And it is thoroughly excellent writing. And it's the best writing in the book.
All right, folks, the Morrissey Book Club. Joel Meyer, executive producer of Soundcheck and de facto president pro tem for life of the Morrissey Book Club. You got to get started reading.
I'm out of here.
No, I've never had a job because I'm
Tony Fletcher is with us, the author of the biography A Light That Will Never Go Out, The Enduring Saga of the Smiths. And so, Tony, let's get to the matter at hand. This year, the self-titled debut album by the Smiths celebrates its 30th anniversary, released February 20th, 1984. By that date, how long had the Smiths been on the scene? Was there a kind of a buzz about them at that point?
There was an incredible buzz about them in Britain just about from the moment that they formed, which was late 1982. It was sudden, and unlike so much else that was going on at the time, it wasn't artificial and it wasn't hyped. The Smiths had signed to an independent label, Rough Trade, that was actually incapable of artificially hyping a band. So when they started attracting a following straight away, and John Peel, the British Radio 1 DJ, fell in love with them, they started getting these radio sessions, it was very, very genuine. People just latched onto this band as something that that was sorely needed. It was one of the most organic things I experienced in the UK. And by the time the album came out in the beginning of 1984, they really were the biggest new band in the UK. And I think American audiences had a sense of that as well.
Let's hear three of the singles that were released on the first album by the Smiths, again, celebrating the 30th anniversary of that record, also called The Smiths. Montage of three of the singles from that first album by the Smiths, Hand in Glove, What Difference Does It Make, and This Charming Man. Tony, here in the States, where we didn't have the benefit of all the build-up and the buzz around the Smiths, that was the first song that I heard from them, This Charming Man, and it was immediately an arresting sound. Morrissey's voice, Johnny Marr's guitar, but I understand there's an asterisk that goes with This Charming Man, at least in the UK.
Well, there is, because in the UK there was back then very much a separation between singles and LPs, as we used to call them, and you really weren't meant to release more than a couple of singles from an album. So bands routinely left the hit single off an album just as an act of kind of credibility, and the Smiths did that with This Charming Man. So UK copies of the debut Smiths album are lacking the song that you quite rightly point out. It's really the song that broke them in the UK as well. You played Hand in Glove, their debut single. That got them some attention. It was a great song. It was remixed for the album. You played the album version, mm-hmm. which is much more sort of lively. But yeah, in the UK, you heard the album without the single that sort of had sent a lot of people out to buy it. And for that reason, I think that the American album is a much better album. It has what was undoubtedly the group's best of their first three singles, without any doubt.
So how does The Smiths, the album by The Smiths, how does it rate as a debut? Rolling Stone magazine put it at number 51 on their list of 100 all-time great debut albums. What do you think?
I would respectfully disagree, and I'm not entirely on my own. There's a big British monthly magazine has the Smiths on the cover this month, and they have a feature on the album and call it that the headline is a flawed masterpiece. And I would kind of lean towards that myself. I think the the problem that they have, because Morrissey has been very clear about having a problem with the album. Right before it came out, he told me in an interview, I think it is a signal post for music. But within a few weeks, he was having second thoughts. The Smiths had already recorded the LP with another producer called Troy Tate and then scrapped it. It was lively, but it sounded a little too much like demos. They'd recorded all the songs for radio sessions. They'd recorded a couple of them for singles. And I think they kind of just ran out of steam a little bit with their new producer, John Porter. And the other thing that happened is that John Porter had a certain view of production, which was wonderful when he came on to produce How Soon Is Now a few months later. Mm-hmm. But he and Morrissey didn't see eye to eye. And I think Morrissey had a few problems with the production. What I find most interesting about this LP is that I think if you come at it from a UK perspective and you have all this preamble, then you do view it as being somewhat flawed. You kind of expected the greatest album ever made, and I think the Smiths got really close with the next couple of albums. But I've spoken to a lot of people in America who's, you know, they were introduced to the Smiths with this album. They'd heard a little bit of the buzz. They'd maybe heard This Charming Man. There were no real videos. They'd read a bit of the press, and they picked up this LP. And because they didn't have any other versions of the songs and nothing else to compare it to, it was a life changer. And I think that's one of the great things about music. It depends the context in which you hear it.
So flawed or not, though, I mean, there was definitely something about the sound of the Smiths. Can you put it down to just Morrissey's voice or just Johnny Marr's playing, or was there some alchemy when the two of them got together?
I think that's the magical word, John, alchemy. They so desperately needed each other. And I think where this LP is so impressive is Morrissey's lyrics are really unlike anything else that had come out. He's singing songs about No, I Never Had a Job Because I Never Wanted One. He's got a song called Miserable Lie. He's Love Is Just a Miserable Lie. There's all this stuff that really kids with teenage angst could totally relate to. And yet you've got this exuberance coming from Johnny Marr. And also, I should stress, coming from the rhythm section of Mike Joyce and Andy Rourke. There's this musical exuberance from three teenage lads. And then there's this 24-year-old, he has been up until now quite a depressed character, and he's finally getting it off his chest, and people can identify with it either way, and they can particularly identify with the whole package.
So the opening Shot Across the Bow, the song called Reel Around the Fountain, would this have been, you know, a good example of the unexpected lyric content?
I think so. And, you know, that was meant to be the Smiths' second single instead of This Charming Man. And the only reason it wasn't was that a British tabloid newspaper kind of set them up and published a piece about potentially paedophilic references in that song the day it was meant to go out on a BBC radio session. And it got pulled. The single had actually been mastered, advertised. There were pressings. It got pulled. And the Smiths went back in to do another BBC session and recorded This Charming Man and realized very quickly that was the better single. So very interesting the way things work out, because I think a kind of 5-minute ballad as the Smiths' second single would not have put them in the limelight the way that This Charming Man did. But Reel Around the Fountain is one of those songs you can listen to it and get out of it what you will. You know, it's time the tale were told of how you took a child and you made him old. What does that quite mean? There's a definite tentative, possibly risque thing there. And I think it sets the Smiths' stall out pretty strongly from the opening lyric.
It's time the tale were told of how you took a child.
Smiths with Reel Around the Fountain from the first album, also called The Smiths, released February 20th, 1984. We're marking the 30th anniversary of the record. Tony Fletcher is author of the biography of The Smiths called A Light That Will Never Go Out, the enduring saga of The Smiths. The band did not endure. What did they have, a five-year run, basically, Tony?
Five-year run, four studio albums, about 17 singles, so many singles that weren't on albums, and then they imploded. I think in retrospect, and Morrissey does finally admit as much in his autobiography, they just never took a break, and they didn't allow themselves management, not at least not consistent management. They had nobody to force them to take a break, and as sometimes happens when you're young and you don't have that kind of, you know, parental figure around you, you end up having a spat, and next you know is you're not talking to each other and you've gone your separate ways. And it's sad, but at the same time, it's one of the most intense catalogs. The amount of music that they recorded in those 4 years between 83 and 87 is astonishing.
But specifically talking about this first record called simply The Smiths, there's another track called The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, which is also kind of in some ways emblematic of what made this band so special that even 25 years after they broke up, people are still really interested in them.
Yeah, I really love this song on the album. I think it's one of it. In the old days, this ended side one, and a song called Suffer Little Children ended side two. Those two songs came out extremely well. And this is Morrissey sort of telling a story. I mean, Morrissey pushed the notion of celibacy around the time this album came out, and that's mm-hmm. obviously been a theme with him. But this is returning to a theme that's in a lot of his early songs. It seems very much rooted in the British black and white movies of the late 50s, early 60s, and the idea of maybe not so much an illegitimate child or somebody being forced into a marriage because they got somebody pregnant. We ended up calling these kitchen sink drama, and it's got that feel to it. And there's a real poetry to this. I think this is Morrissey at his most poetic, and it's not personal. And I think the musicianship is way beyond that of your average bunch of, you know, 19 and 20 year olds. And it's a great choice to play. Yes.
The Hand That Rocks the Cradle from The Smiths.
Please don't cry. Ghost and the storm outside will not invade this sacred shrine or infiltrate your mind. My life down I shall lie if the bogeyman should try to play tricks on your sacred mind. Shadows loom. Our piano plays in an empty room. There'll be blood on the cleaver tonight. And when darkness lifts and the room is bright, I'll still be by your side. For you are all that matters, and I love you till the day I die. There never
The Hand That Rocks the Cradle from The Smiths' album, The Smiths, their self-titled debut released 30 years ago. So, Tony, how does this debut album set up what would come the next year, the big hit single How Soon Is Now, and what many people consider their finest LP, Meat Is Murder?
I think the Smiths were initially just really glad to get that body of work behind them, the initial songs, of which there were probably about 20. A bunch of them ended up on B-sides, etc. Later in the year, they released a compilation, Hatful of Hollow. So they had two albums out in 84. And I think just this burst of creativity. And I always think it's fascinating to see when a group gets beyond that debut LP, have they got what it takes to move up a notch? Or was it all in the early work? You know, once those early songs are done with, can you write better songs? And the Smiths just grabbed, you know, the opportunity that was given them and soared. They just like soared with it. And of course, How Soon Is Now, initially a B-side, but then picked up on by the American record label Sire as an A-side and became a kind of, you know, college anthem. And
right.
And really, for many people, it's the song that they know the Smiths by. And that was put on that Meat Is Murder album, the same way that This Charming Man is not on the UK UK pressings of the first Smiths album. Meet His Murder does not include How Soon Is Now in the UK.
Right, but here in the States, we got both.
Yes, you did.
And now we have Tony Fletcher among us, the author of the biography, A Light That Will Never Go Out, The Enduring Saga of the Smiths. We've been marking the 30th anniversary of the first album by the Smiths. And Tony, always great to talk to you. Thanks very much.
Likewise. Thank you.
I'm the sun and the air, of a shyness that is criminally vulgar. I am sun and air, but nothing in particular. You should shine.
Up next, we'll talk about another debut. It's the Animal Heart record by Swedish indie pop star Nina Persson. The former frontwoman of the Cardigans joins us to play some songs from her solo debut next on Soundcheck.
You can go.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Sometimes you look at the career of a musician and you look at all the things that that person has done. Founded a couple of great bands, scored a big chart hit, collaborated with people like Danger Mouse and Sparkle Horse, and then you realize, wait a minute, that musician has never released a solo album. The musician I'm thinking of in particular is the Swedish-born, New York-based singer Nina Persson. Most of us first encountered her when she fronted the Cardigans and sang that infectious hit Love Fool. Next, she formed a project called A-Camp, working with her husband Nathan Larson. Now, Nina Persson is finally ready for her solo. Here to perform the title track from her new album Animal Heart, here's Nina Persson and her band live on Soundcheck.
Tides at our door, feel the pull of the moon. I'm tired of these lies, want to float with you. My ocean, my heart, anchor you to me. You can blink like a star, sink like a stone in the sea. Yo. done with this dance, baby, bail with me. My ocean, my heart, anchor you to me. You can blink like a star or sing like a stone in the sea. Come be my man, baby, bail with me. Come be my man, baby, hang on to me. Come be my man, baby, bail with me. Come be my man, baby, hang on to me. Come be my man, baby, bail with me. Come be my man, baby, hang on to me.
That is Nina Persson, live on Soundcheck with Animal Heart, the title track from her new album, her first solo effort after so many years of performing with the Cardigans and A Camp and Citizens Band and all the other things, Nina, we've heard you do over the years. Great to have you back with us.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Brian Cantor is behind our drum kit, Grant Zabritsky playing keyboards, David Dowda playing the electric guitar. On our website at soundcheck.org, we have the video for that song, for Animal Heart.
All right.
What a lot of fun that is.
You like it, yeah?
One long tracking shot.
Yeah.
Apparently, when you go out in the morning to buy a quart of milk,
That's right.
Like a big deal.
Yeah, and I had to go out and buy 7 quarts of milk before that video was done.
So where was that shot in? It was here in New York, right?
Yep.
In Harlem, maybe?
It's Harlem, yeah.
And so you see, I mean, it's like the lowest budget video. It's really funny. But you actually see like real New Yorkers who are clearly not part of the shoot just kind of standing around. Did you get a lot of funny looks? Or
yeah, there were, because we did wind up having 7 takes that we had to choose between. And in some of the takes, you could see most passersby were super excited and a lot of kids just hung out for a long time, daring each other to jump into the frame and so on. But there were, you see some passersby looking really annoyed. You know how you can feel in New York City sometimes, like this movie shoots all the time blocking your way.
Right, right.
So you could see those glances looking at me when I was like lip syncing and, you know, trying to look like I, you know, knew what I was doing.
Now, are they playing the song so that people at least know what it is you're doing, or are you just walking down the street miming to a song people can't hear?
To a song in my head. We did have some sort of a boombox on the camera person's shoulder. Mm-hmm. It wasn't super loud. It wasn't like the whole block was pumping from the song, but
right.
It was, the volume was low enough for it to be a little bit embarrassing for me.
And you had to do it 7 times.
Yeah. Oh, that was, we did way more. 7 was what we could at least look at.
Uh-huh. So it is one long tracking shot.
Yeah.
Nicely done. Folks, check it out. It is really worth 4 minutes of your time. The video for Animal Heart, it is the title track from Nina Persson's new record, solo record. How different is this from A Camp, for example, the band you and Nathan Larson have had over the years?
It's not. I don't think it's tremendously different at all.
Since he's all over this record.
Like, yeah, exactly. I did it with Nathan. We had a new person involved this time, though, too. Eric Johnson from Fruit Bats, for example.
And formerly The Shins.
Exactly, yeah. So that, of course, brought in a new sort of identity a little bit. I feel like this could have been, I feel like there is some sort of a red line through anything that I've done, kind of. It's just, I mean, it's different because I work with different people, but I still feel like I cannot erase my identity.
Do you see this as a concept record? Because you keep coming back to themes of nature and environment and animals and people trying to make a home in all of that.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is a concept record in as much as every record I've done has had some sort of central theme that I've stuck to a little bit. But I also I've talked about animals on many records, and maybe not so much homes and houses. That might be something that's new and central.
Does having a toddler in the house change, just on a practical level, the way you can make music?
Yeah, That's the only way it changes. This creatively, it's actually luckily the same, but practically and logistically, it's very different. You have to work when he's at school, mm-hmm. and that's in daylight, which is new to me. And yeah, absolutely. But it's been I've had to get used to that. But it's also, in retrospect, it's been only good. Mm. It's only good things to come from getting a little more organized and structured, to be honest.
So you were a night owl before this?
Yeah, I thought that was the only time I could write and be creative. Which maybe, I mean, I don't know. I haven't tried in a long time because I just can't do it. I need to get up in the mornings. But it's not, that was a misconception. I thought that I had to suffer a little bit when I was creative, which is not true.
Well, but you did suffer. I mean, you had a diagnosis of cervical cancer at one mm-hmm. point,
yeah.
which you not only beat, but then had your son Nils after
yeah,
that, which
yeah.
is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, so see, you don't need to bring on extra suffering
absolutely.
Than there already is. That's yeah. what I learned, I think.
So in the liner notes, when you thank the two N's in your alphabet, is mm-hmm. that Nathan and Nils?
That's Nathan and Nils, yeah.
That's nice. Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Nina Persson. Her album is called Animal Heart. It is her first solo album under her own name. And she's playing for us here today and playing on April 16th in Williamsburg at the club Babies All Right. What is the status of the Cardigans? I mean, you guys did like some festivals and stuff in 2012, is that?
Yeah, we did that, and that was a lot of fun, and we had more fun than we've had in a long time. So we also did a little tour in November last year.
Oh.
It was just like 2 weeks in Asia and in Russia. Really a lot of fun, too. So we're sort of, we're still dormant. We haven't yeah. made any new music, but we're enjoying playing a lot. And I can see that we'll keep doing that. And it'd be fun to do more new music too, because you can only do so much of greatest hits playing. So we're still sort of frustratingly just on ice. People really want yes or no if we exist or not. But we exist. We're just really slow.
Nina Persson is with us here in the Soundcheck studio. Again, Animal Heart is her solo record, which is out now. And she and the band are going to play a song called Forgot to Tell You live on Soundcheck.
Forgot to tell you about something. Don't know what, don't know what, don't know what.
Nina Persson and the band Live on Soundcheck Forgot to Tell You is the name of the song from her solo album Animal Heart, which is out now. Nina and company will be playing on April 16th in Williamsburg at Baby's All Right. They're playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today. We're asking all this week, we're asking our listeners and our guests, are you a Beatles person or a Stones person?
I am a Beatles person. If there's to be a choice, I'm a Beatles person.
Why?
It's just what I have listened the most to in my life, and I just think their playfulness is really fun. Rolling Stones is sexier for sure.
Mm-hmm.
If forced to choose, I'll say the Beatles.
Okay. Well, this week only, and for this moment only, you were forced to choose.
Yeah.
Nina Persson's album is called Animal Heart. It's out now. Great to see you again. Thanks
you
so
too.
Much for bringing
Thank
the
you.
Band in.
Sure.
Last time I quit smoking, there was a flash of light.
Up next, when Bob Dylan and Simon and Garfunkel recorded some of their most memorable songs, a producer named Tom Wilson was on the other side of the studio glass. Hear about this influential but unsung hero of music history. That's next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. I want to play a little something for you, a song off of Bringing It All Back Home. This was the Bob Dylan album where Dylan went electric, occasioning much wailing and gnashing of teeth in folk circles. Listen to the start of this song called Bob Dylan's 115th Dream.
I was riding on the Mayflower when I thought I spied some men.
Start again. Wait a minute now. Okay, take two.
I was riding on the Mayflower and I thought I spot some land. I yelled for Captain E-Rib.
So that's how you make a record. Well, the voice, the first voice, of course, is Bob Dylan. The other voice is the producer, Tom Wilson. Never heard of him? Well, the writer Michael Hall says most people haven't. Michael's recent piece for Texas Monthly explores the life of the man he calls the greatest producer you've never heard of. And Michael Hall joins me on the line from Austin, Texas. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. So I'm going to assume that since you wrote about him for Texas Monthly, that this guy is originally from Texas?
He's from Waco, Texas, right in the heart of the state.
Mm-hmm. Now, producers often aren't marquee names, but, you know, we know Phil Spector, we know George Martin, Brian Eno, Rick Rubin. Does this guy belong in that pantheon? And if so, why don't we know him?
I think he absolutely belongs in that pantheon. I mean, if you look at the work that Tom Wilson did, particularly in the 60s, you know, I mean, when I was a kid, half the records that I had, it seemed, Dylan or the Velvet Underground or Simon and Garfunkel, had this guy's name, Tom Wilson, on it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he never kind of reached that, I don't know, that critical mass with people. He had some great hits in the mid-60s, but kind of he faded away, and he just never stuck in the consciousness like Phil Spector or Rick Rubin or somebody like that.
Now, Phil Spector, Rick Rubin, both white, Tom Wilson, black. Do you think that would have had something to do with it?
It could have. You know, I mean, he was hired by Columbia as an A&R guy. He was the first black guy hired by Columbia. And, you know, there's some speculation in all the history that they stuck him with Dylan because they thought, I mean, they were having some issues with Dylan and, you know, getting him to do what they wanted him to do. And so they thought, well, we'll get him with this black guy and maybe that'll make a difference with this, you know, this angry folk singer. you know, it's what's fascinating to me is that you know, and we're talking here the early 60s, you know, and here's this guy who came from segregated Waco and had these Catholic tastes that went from, you know, Dylan to the noise rock of the Velvet Underground to he did a lot of the really early avant-garde jazz stuff to Zappa to, you know, stuff like Sky Pilot, you know, by well, the Animals. I mean, he was just this really unusual guy.
Well, now, as you mentioned, when they first hook him up with Dylan, he wasn't such a big folk fan. He was coming out of the jazz world. He had gone to Harvard, started his own jazz record label, and like his first groups of musicians that he worked with show that he had an incredible ear for avant-garde jazz.
Yeah, Cecil Taylor and Sun Ra. You know, I mean, he put out some of the first records by these guys who were, you know, kind of young and beating the hustings way out there in the wilderness. But, you know, he goes to Chicago to record Sun Ra. I mean, you know, who does that?
Tom Wilson did. And he also recorded very early in his career a young Cecil Taylor. Listen to this 1956 recording of Cecil Taylor playing Bemsha Swing. Very young Cecil Taylor playing Bemsha Swing from his album Jazz Advance, a 1956 record made by Tom Wilson, young producer just out of school, starting his own label, and the subject of Michael Hall's piece for the Texas Monthly called The Greatest Producer You've Never Heard Of. So he's got his own label. He's recording, you know, Donald Byrd and Sun Ra and Cecil Taylor, great names, but he's not making money. So he takes on, he moves into the industry, ends up at Columbia, and then ends up working with Bob Dylan. At this point, you know, we're talking, what, 1964, somewhere around there, 65?
Yeah.
So what would Columbia have expected him as a producer to do with Bob Dylan?
I think a lot of people were wondering what to do with Dylan, and you know, basically what he did on the first records he did with Dylan was set up the mic and, you know, roll tape, which is what John Hammond had done too, because mm-hmm. Dylan was really into just playing by himself. There's this great anecdote though that Wilson is already thinking of, you know, Wilson thinks in terms of bands. You know, he thinks in terms of people working with other musicians, and he makes a suggestion to Dylan's manager, you know, you put a band behind this guy, and, you know, he'd sound like a white Ray Charles. But Dylan wants to do the acoustic thing, and, you know, I think one of the real hallmarks of what Tom Wilson did is at a certain point in there, he did sense that there was something there that could be, you know, brought out with a band, literally amplified. So he starts playing around with some of Dylan's acoustic stuff, putting bands on, you know, after the fact, mm-hmm, which mm-hmm. doesn't really work. But at some point, you know, for that record that you just played, you know, he has the idea of bringing in an actual band behind him, and Dylan likes it, and it really does start to change the way pop music is made.
So a failed attempt at first with Dylan's recording of House of the Rising Sun, overdubbing a band behind Dylan, that didn't work, but eventually with this album bringing it all back home, it does work, and Tom Wilson claimed he was responsible for Dylan going electric, and Dylan doesn't seem to disagree.
Right. I mean, there is an interview with Jan Wenner and
of Rolling Stone.
Of Rolling Stone magazine, and he brings up Wilson's claim, and Dylan basically, you know, he chuckles, but he says, you know what, that's pretty much true.
Well, let's hear Bob Dylan's Subterranean Homesick Blues, because Tom Wilson famously appears in D.A. Pennebaker's classic cue card video of this song from Bob Dylan.
John is in a basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on the pavement thinking about the government. The man in a trench coat, badge out, laid off, says he's got a bad cough, wants to get it paid off. Look out, kid, it's something you did. God knows when, but you're doing it again. You better duck down the alleyway looking for a new friend. The man in a coonskin cap in a pig pen wants $11 bills. You only got 10. Maggie comes fleet-foot, face full of black soot, talking at the heat, put plants in the bed, but the phone's tapped anyway. Maggie says the men say they must bust an early man. Orders from the DA, look out, kid, don't matter what you did. Walk on your tiptoes, don't tie no bows, better stay away from those that carry around a fire hose. Keep a clean nose, wash your clean clothes, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows.
Bob Dylan's Subterranean Homesick Blues, and if you haven't seen the famous film, or the video, so to speak, for this song, it's Bob Dylan with all the lyrics on cue cards, and he's just dropping one cue card after the other as the song goes along. And there's Tom Wilson, really tall guy.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, a long, tall Texan, as the song says.
He was a very tall, a very handsome, very suave guy.
And a big hit with the ladies, you intimate in your article.
According to people who worked with him, Tom Wilson spent a lot of time in the control room talking to the ladies on the telephone.
We're speaking on the telephone with Michael Hall, staff writer for Texas Monthly. His recent piece about Tom Wilson, the producer, is called The Greatest Music Producer You've Never Heard Of. So here's this tall black guy from Texas coming out of the jazz world. And he and Bob Dylan have made music history. You know, Dylan's gone electric. They've recorded like a Rolling Stone together. Everything's going well. And then it seems like the two of them split up for some reason. Do we know why?
No, we really don't. Dylan, he had already been with Wilson for the better part of a little bit more than three albums. But, yeah, they just do one more song. But the really great thing is that that song is, in some people's minds, the greatest song in rock and roll history.
And that is Like a Rolling Stone.
There you go.
So we talked before about Tom Wilson trying, you know, early on in his work with Dylan to overdub a band behind the solo Bob Dylan, and that didn't work out. But it did work for another group. Let's talk about Tom Wilson and Simon and Garfunkel. Tell the story of Sound of Silence.
Well, Wilson had, you know, signed this young folk group, and they made this acoustic record, Wednesday morning, 3 a.m. And, you know, the record didn't really go anywhere, and Simon and Garfunkel basically split up. You know, Paul Simon moved to Europe, I think, and was knocking around Europe. And Garfunkel, I think, went back to college, and, you know, I mean, they were young guys.
Mm-hmm.
And so but the song was getting some airplay in Florida and in Boston. And so, you know, Wilson, you know, again, had this idea of what a band could do for a song. And so he takes that acoustic song and goes back in the studio, puts a backing band behind it, including a couple of guys that he'd used on the Dylan sessions, and they make this completely new song and release it completely unbeknownst to Simon and Garfunkel, and it becomes a huge hit, number one hit in 1965. And, you know, it turned Simon and Garfunkel into, you know, one of the biggest groups in pop music.
So let's hear what happened before Tom Wilson's intervention. Here's the original Simon and Garfunkel version of Sound of Silence.
Of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone. Narrow streets of cobblestone. Neath the halo of a street lamp, I turned my collar to the cold and damp. When my eyes were stabbed by the flash of a neon light, it split the night and touched the sound of silence.
So there's the original version of Simon and Garfunkel's Sound of Silence. It's already a good song. Tom Wilson knows that. But he decides it's missing something. So he adds a band and gets this.
In restless dreams I walked alone. Narrow streets of cobblestone. Neath the halo of a street lamp, I turned my collar to the cold and damp. When my eyes were stabbed by the flash of a neon light, split the night and touched the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more. People talking without speaking. People hearing without listening. People writing songs that voices never share.
So that's the version of Sound of Silence that we all know and love. Became a number one hit by the end of 1965, and it's because of Tom Wilson, the producer, that the song became a big hit. And as Michael Hall just told us, it's because of Tom Wilson that Simon and Garfunkel got back together and became such an important... I mean, it just, you know, if he did nothing other than that song, it's such a great example, Michael, of the art of the producer.
It really is. It's the beginning of the jangle, you know? I mean, you hear that, you go, oh, my God, look at that, you know? It's this guy who just says, I got an idea here.
Well, he was full of ideas. He thought the Velvet Underground were an interesting band, and as we all know now, with John Cale and the late Lou Reed, they were way more than an interesting band. They turned out to be hugely important.
Yeah, he sought out the Velvet Underground. He saw them play in some club and said, I like these guys. I like what they're doing. You know, which was a pretty unusual thing to think for a record producer, a mainstream record producer.
And Frank Zappa as well, early records by Frank Zappa, the jazz rock band Soft Machine from England, Hugh Masekela, the South African trumpeter. He dies at the age of 47. In 1978, you report in your piece that it was a heart attack, but really we don't know anything else about what was going on then.
No, you know, there's this, you know, he was on the cover of the New York Times magazine, a story, a really long story they did on him in 1968. And he was the biggest producer in America. I mean, people were coming to him, bringing stuff to him. He was this kingmaker. And yet, by like 2 years later, he's virtually producing nobody, 1970. And then, for the most part, he stops.
Well, he himself, a son of Waco, Texas, he is not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Michael Hall sort of calling out to Cleveland to get this guy into the hall in his article. He certainly belongs. The piece for the Texas Monthly is called The Greatest Music Producer You've Never Heard Of, The Story of Tom Wilson. Michael Hall, this has been really great. Thanks very much for sharing it with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
This is Soundcheck.
The dawning, it's just a restless feeling.
Tomorrow on the show, we've been asking you all week to pick a side, Beatles or Stones. Make your case at soundcheck.org or call us at 866-939-1612.
So, it's Charles Johnson. Well, I'd say the Stones. I remember when they came out with Sticky Fingers, 1971. The first time I saw that zipper, Sticky Fingers with the zipper, that was really unique. And actually working zipper on a cover, they were pretty wicked.
Once again, tell us which side of our great debate you come down on, Beatles or Stones. Call 866-939-1612 or leave us a comment at soundcheck.org. Tomorrow, one of our guests from the upcoming Beatles vs. Stones Smackdown at the New York Public Library will join us. That's Bill Janovitz from the band Buffalo Tom. He'll talk about his book, Rocks Off, 50 Tracks That Tell the Story of the Rolling Stones. Also tomorrow, the band St. Rich. They actually grew out of another indie project, an instrumental group known as Delicate Steve. But St. Rich has vocals, and we'll speak with singer Christian Peslock and guitarist Steve Marion, and they'll perform as St. Rich in our studio. That's tomorrow on the program. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.